Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Federal government shutdown started a month ago on December 22nd. It is the longest shutdown in U.S. history, and cybersecurity experts warn it is testing the vulnerability of government websites' security. Motherboard tech writer Joseph Cox has been covering the issue. He joins us now. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What do we know? I mean, is this a sort of a security issue that is a creeper? It happens in bits and pieces. Was there immediate problems? What do we know?
I mean, it's going to get worse the longer the shutdown goes on. Let's say it goes on for another few weeks. That's going to increase the amount of information that when the government eventually does come back, experts are going to have to go through all of this data and analyze that in bulk. Maybe there's an attack that they didn't detect that they would have if there were more staff. And they're going to have to go through all of that data. So it's exponentially getting worse and worse as this shutdown goes on.
Yeah. What isn't available during this partial government shutdown to ensure security?
I mean, the most glaring issue is there's simply fewer staff. Defending against hackers isn't just a technological issue. It's a human resources issue. You need people to combat against hackers and their tools and whatever it may be. So if you have fewer analysts, for example, who are going through that data, maybe they're going to miss a particular attack or something that would have been caught before. But then there's even more tangible, immediate impacts. I mean, there is a body called the National Institute of Standards and Technology that probably most people haven't heard of, but that's the part of the U.S. government that tells everybody else, hey, when you deploy encryption, you should do it like this. This is the best way. And because of the shutdown, that website is currently offline and nobody can see those standards, so nobody can follow them. And then we also have encryption certificates. Without getting too technical, these are the files that make sure that when you go to a website, it's the real one. But because of the shutdown, they haven't been renewed. So there's a chance there the hackers may be able to manipulate data in that way as well during the shutdown.
And at this point, we don't know if there's any evidence that anyone's hacked into anything because there aren't enough people on board to detect that sort of thing.
Right, exactly. And of course, if they do find anything serious, it's likely to be classified anyway. And then, as it usually is with these large profile hacks, maybe we'll find out in 6 months or a year or whatever it may be. But if I was Iran or Russia or China, it would be foolish if I wasn't trying to take advantage of this opportunity when the defenses are lowered and there are fewer people to look out for adversaries like this.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what the government shutdown means to our cybersecurity in the government. My guest is Joseph Cox. He is a writer for Motherboard Tech, and he's been covering this issue. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. So close to half of the employees within the Department of Homeland Security, Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency are furloughed. Another 85% of that National Institute of Standards and Technology have been furloughed. And I'm thinking about Homeland Security right now. How can that not be? How can those employees be furloughed? It seems like there's our national security's at stake.
Right, exactly. I mean, there are, of course, other components that are still operational. You're going to have, of course, your intelligence agencies and components of the DoD, which will be doing a cybersecurity aspect. They may be more, as I said, focused on intelligence or offensive operations. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we increasingly categorize cybersecurity elements as critical infrastructure.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be the power grid or maybe voting machines, of course, not right at the moment, mm-hmm. but that sort of thing. Cyber is such a critical component of our everyday lives now, of our everyday governance, that it does seem foolish that it is being neglected during the shutdown. Yeah, because this is the area where attacks happen now. And attacks against the U.S. government are happening constantly. They are not, of course, all to the same degree of, say, the DNC hack or something like that. They may mm-hmm. be much lower level as well. But it's a constant threat coming from adversaries against the U.S. in the cybersecurity realm.
Yeah, I mean, hackers have successfully penetrated the government's cybersecurity defenses when they're at full staff. That's what you're saying, is if you were one of the actors from one of these countries that are not friendly, it should be a no-brainer at this point.
Right, yeah. And if I recall correctly, the OPM hack, which is where Chinese state-linked hackers stole a load of highly sensitive information from the United States on the country's assets. If I recall correctly, that was done during a time when the OPM department had fewer staff members. So if you were Chinese-backed hackers once again, and of course, we originally did have the Obama and President Xi sort of truce when it came to hacking a few years ago. That has now changed, and the Chinese are ramping up their operations again. It would be bizarre if they weren't looking at this and seeing it as a good opportunity to maybe get some more malware into some US government systems. But I say all that, of course, only on the premise that we, as you say, we don't actually know. It just, it seems there is a much greater risk of this sort of activity.
How are the people in charge of, you know, cybersecurity for Homeland Security and Infrastructure Security Agency, how are they responding to this? I mean, what are they saying? Anything?
Well, I can't talk specifically about senior DHS and those sorts of departments, but recently, in a related issue, at least when it comes to cybersecurity, we reported last week that telco giants such as AT&T and T-Mobile and Sprint are selling phone location data to unauthorized parties. Now, the chairman of the FCC was called to hold an emergency briefing on this issue, but because of the shutdown, and this was the reason that he gave, because of the shutdown, he said that's not going to be possible. So clearly there's also impact even on the highest levels of these government departments where they're not getting work done.
How long can this go on? I mean, is there a tipping point, do you think?
I mean, of course, I can't say how long the government shutdown itself will go on, but it will just keep building up and building up. And perhaps if an attack becomes public or something like that, then maybe more resources can be diverted. But as I mentioned, it is just going to exponentially increase when it comes to the risk. And when those government employees do eventually come back, they're just going to have so much more work to do than if they just stayed there the entire time. They're going to have so much catching up to do to actually get to the point where they can say, okay, we are safe, or we did find an attack during that time. But they have to do those checks after the shutdown ends as well.
And there's nobody around to turn things off and to avoid the hacks at this point.
Yeah, so, I mean, one DHS department was, I mean, there are some people working, right? There is 2,000 down from 3,500. Mm-hmm. But that may sound not like a drastic amount, but it's nearly half the workforce, and that is still a significant a number when you are going to be dealing with constant threats every single day.
Is there anything that Congress or the president can do to change it? I mean, the president has ended, I think they've talked about ending the shutdown for some agencies, right?
Yeah, I believe so. And then as I mentioned, like if there was a critical issue, maybe if there was a serious cybersecurity attack and they did need to bring in resources, they may be able to do that.
But how are they going to know?
Exactly. I mean, we're just going to have to hope that, hey, maybe they will catch something and they say, okay, now we need to bring in more resources. But of course, they may also miss it as well. I mean, as for sort of what happens after this, just another thing I would add is that this isn't a great look when it comes to recruiting. Mm-hmm. The government already competes enough with private industry. Private industry offers better salaries, better perks.
Better equipment.
Yeah, exactly. And then who is going to be a well-trained, defensive cybersecurity expert, look at this and say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go work for the DHS or another part of the U.S. government and not get paid, essentially, for doing really hard, technical, sophisticated work when they could just go to the private industry. I feel like the knock-on effects of this aren't immediately tangible, but sort of the long-term effects could be even more worrying than what we're actually thinking about right now.
Have you heard about people in these positions with the federal government that are looking for other work?
I mean, you always hear about people leaving cybersecurity roles in the government and going into private industry. That's something of a norm, but I would not be surprised now if people were thinking about that a lot more seriously. There is maybe not a revolving door, it depends on the department and the role, but there is constant movement between these two realms. And yeah, I would not be surprised if people were thinking about leaving maybe earlier than they were going to.
And what are cybersecurity experts saying about this?
I mean, basically all of the same as that. And one has emphasized the slow on the recruiting. They've also brought up that, I believe it was Matthew Green from Johns Hopkins University, what I mentioned about the National Institute of Standards and Technology website mm-hmm. being down, and now they can't access these documents. He said that these private companies that rely on those to go check them, maybe somebody is now going to put encryption in their financial product run or something like that. I mean, maybe they could find the information elsewhere, but that's a critical resource, not just for the government, but for the private companies that then rely on it as well.
Hmm. Well, Joseph Cox, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Joseph Cox is a motherboard tech writer. He's been covering this issue of what happens to government cybersecurity during even a partial shutdown. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Tech innovators flocked to the annual Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas last week. Games and gadgets, innovations and inspirations are highlighted at the annual event that this year gave a turn to technology for older people. Joining us by phone is the Vice President of Innovation for AARP, Andy Miller. Andy attended the Consumer Electronics Show last week. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Do you always go to the Consumer Electronics Show?
So historically, AARP has been at the Consumer Electronics Show mostly as a sponsor or maybe a member of a panel. This year, we took a vastly different approach. Our CEO had a significant presence. We actually had a booth in the smart home section where we launched two products that AARP built, along with three startups that we are engaged with, all trying to solve for, in the case of the booth, social isolation and loneliness. We know that social isolation and loneliness are worse for your health than smoking or obesity, so it's something we're really focused on, and how do you leverage tech. Personally, I've been going to CES for a number of years. I come out of the tech industry, so mm-hmm. It is a fascinating show, to say the least, and the broad spectrum of what you see there is amazing, right, and the different solutions that you're seeing folks focused on building.
Have they been focused on tech for older people for a long time now, or are we turning a corner?
I think we're turning a corner. In Joanne Jenkins, our CEO, who was there, her role is really trying to intersect a concept or a book she has called Disrupt Aging with what we call the longevity economy. What we know is that $7.6 trillion of economic activity occur each year in the U.S., from people over the age of 50. So you're starting to see more companies, big and small, pay attention to the category because there's significant dollars there. But when you think about tech, it should be ageless design, right? We try and promote, don't build tech for millennials. Don't build tech for older folks. Build a product that's ageless in design and experience. I often talk about the iPad as the example, right? A 2-year-old can pick it up and figure it out, mm-hmm. and a 70-year-old can pick it up and figure it out. So we're less focused on sort of, I'll say, naming things, and more focused on how do we just provide great experiences for people of all ages. We want people of every age to thrive and grow, and we also are really focused on and it's not lost on us, the notion of intergenerational. So you're seeing whether it's in the workplace where you have four generations of people, or whether it's, you know, just at home living with, you know, a grandparent, parent, child, they're all using tech. And so how do we create an environment, a system, an ecosystem that really pushes the folks, big company, small company, to think about how they build things differently? And so that was one of our key themes at the show. And then we released some research as well around that and how specifically folks over the age of 50 are utilizing tech, because we want people to think about this. We want people to design differently and really focus on, there's a big opportunity.
Yeah, right, to make money. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is the Vice President of Innovation for AARP, Andy Miller. We're talking about tech for older people today. It became a focus at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago. Andy Miller's here to talk about what stood out to them at AARP, which took a more of a leading role at the CES. So, Andy Miller, what did stand out to you that didn't come from AARP that you feel like is responding to this growing demand?
Yeah, so the first thing I'll say stood out to anyone that was at the show was the sheer number of integrations you were seeing with Google Assistant. Right, a couple years ago, it was all Alexa and Alexa skills. Mm-hmm. And this year, Google made a huge push. And so you saw integrations, and Google actually put people in non-Google booths, right, if someone had done an integration. But what the key there, whether it's Alexa or Google, is the proliferation of voice technology, right, especially for seniors, where they may have dexterity issues or mobility issues, different reasons why they can't use certain devices. Mm-hmm. And voice will let you use anything and everything. So I'll give you a couple of really interesting examples of what we saw. Kohler, the faucet company, I'll call it the faucet company, right? They actually have a faucet that has an Alexa integration that enables you to talk to it. So you could, if you got your hands full, let's say you're just cooking a big meal, or maybe you're a caregiver for someone, and you need exactly a cup of water at a certain temperature for your recipe that you're making. You can talk to Alexa and say, "Alexa, I need a cup of water that's 52 degrees." And you can hold your pot underneath the faucet, and it will pour exactly a cup of water at 52 degrees. Right? So you're starting to see this really interesting intersection, right, that creates convenience for me. It creates, if I'm really into making sure I have exact measurement, it's a time saver. There's so many different things there that you wouldn't think about.
Yeah.
So that's really fascinating. The other interesting thing we're seeing is finally it seems like 3D printers, they've been around for a bit, but finally it seems like the use cases for them are creating real value. So we were at a booth called Form Labs, and they have a 3D printer that can print everything from crowns to dentures, to jewelry. And so when you start thinking about that, the price point of a crown or dentures may have been prohibitive for some, but they can bring the price point down to like $5 or $10. So at that level, it's sort of accessible for all. And so I think there's some really interesting tech that in use cases no one's really thinking about.
Huh. There's a lot of wearable tech as well.
Yeah, wearable's interesting. I think it's still got a little bit of ways to go. Mm-hmm. You know, we see watches everywhere. The problem with watches, I still have to remember to wear it. I still have to make sure it's charged. Mm-hmm. We talk a lot about wearables become really interesting when that technology is stitched into the fabric itself. So when I put my shirt on or my sock, you see it in socks today, I put a pair of socks on, the tech actually is in the clothing, in the actual fabric. That becomes really interesting because now there's not a stigma of maybe a certain type of device, or I have an Apple Watch that's got 400 apps on it, right? So the best technology is the technology that fades into the background and provides significant value.
A huge issue coming up with this dominance of older people coming up by 2035 is memory. Memory issues, Alzheimer's, other kinds, forms of dementia. What did you see that's responding to that? Because that kind of is getting to the issue of the tech being built into the fiber of the clothes.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple different things when you start looking at disease specific. You always have a fear of, you know, if someone with dementia or Alzheimer's, right, you always have that fear of wandering off, mm-hmm. right, getting that phone call. So when you start thinking about how do you take that technology and not just use it for tracking, potentially, but also to start to get health data, right? So you're seeing more and more of these wearables start to collect vital signs, right? Be able to then in real time send them to a caregiver or send them to a clinician, right? And then there's sort of the closed loop, right? Something can come back and it's actionable for that mm-hmm. person or for the caregiving team. So you're definitely seeing stuff like that. You're also seeing a lot around fall, not just detection, but fall prevention, right? Because especially we know falls are one of the worst things that can happen in a home, that your health can just spiral, right, from a fall.
Mm-hmm.
So really interesting tech around fall prevention. And again, tech that's fading into the background, tech that's running and you don't even know it's running and it's interacting with the chemical composition of your body.
Like what?
So there's a company out of Emerald, or a company at MIT called Emerald, that has a device that looks like a router, and that router basically creates a mesh network in your home, and it is capable of interacting with the water composition in your body, and it knows if you're sitting, standing, it can actually track your breathing. It knows if you've eaten. It tracks your movement throughout the home. It can look at period-over-period analysis of your gait, right, which is one of the biggest predictors of a fall in the future. So it's I don't have to wear a pendant. I don't have to wear a watch. I don't have to wear anything in that case. It's just there, and it's on all the time. And it is much less Big Brother. You're seeing other solutions leveraging cameras, for example, that are much more invasive, and people don't wear, or IoT sensors
mm-hmm.
you know, throughout the house. And it's just much more invasive, and people, one, don't necessarily want the sort of Big Brother approach.
Right.
And two, it feels like you have to be a techie to be able to put these things together, right? You can go buy a bunch of smart sensors, home sensors, and hook them up to an Alexa, but, you know, if you feel like you need a PhD to make the integrations work and have that Alexa skill that will do all those things. So especially where you have caregivers that are buying it for the people that they're caring for,
mm-hmm.
They're often not very sophisticated when it comes to, let me set up a network of IoT devices to interact with an app on my smartphone. So the simpler is better, but definitely seeing more and more that are, I'll say, tech that you're seeing disease specific or focused, which is a nice thing to see. We did see, I'll call them wristbands. I don't know how to describe them
mm-hmm.
For folks with Parkinson's, and you know, if you have tremors
mm-hmm.
and you put these on, and they have little gyroscopes inside them. And when you wear them, all of a sudden your tremors stop and you have complete control of your hands again. That's pretty cool.
You know, by 2035, a lot of older people are going to be, outside of the issue of Alzheimer's and dementia, there are going to be a lot more people who are more tech savvy in that age group, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Every day, you know, people are getting more tech savvy, right? As people get older and turn 65, they've been accustomed. You know, you look at the 50 to 60 cohort today, and they're mm-hmm. they're the ones that are adopting. They're early adopters of many technologies. So yeah, I think you're seeing a generation over generation wave of tech happening.
Yeah. Do you feel like at this point they're responding to our old thumbnail? A description of an older person, or the one that's going away, or are they responding to the upcoming, or all of the above?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So AARP did this fascinating commercial where they brought out some 20-somethings and they introduced them, and they asked them what's old, right? And they're like, oh, 70, 60, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they bring a person out that was that age, and they had to teach each other something.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a woman who was teaching someone, I think, like yoga or planking or something. And it was a young man. He could not do it to save his life. And at the end of the commercial, the video, it was, so what is old? And so, yeah, I do think you're seeing more and more folks that are changing the definition of old, right? And old is just a number. It's not a state of being. And so tech can enable that. Tech can empower you to live however you want.
And you mentioned early on in our conversation the issue of what I call universal design, that we don't need to think of it for a certain group of people. We just need, if anybody can use a touch-free faucet.
Correct.
Anybody could use, I would love to have a faucet that measures out a cup of water for me.
Yeah, in fact, I'll argue that if you do build any tech for any cohort, you're doing yourself a disservice, because you're automatically going to sort of alienate the other cohorts that probably find value in your product.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so it may change how they're marketed as well?
Yeah, I absolutely, right? I don't know that there's always going to be very specific use cases for specific mm-hmm. cohorts, which is fine. But it doesn't mean that it can't, you know, you can build a product that can be marketed to multiple cohorts. There's just different campaigns probably, right? And different, maybe slightly different value props.
Do you see a future in robotics and dealing with people who are older, particularly when it comes to issues of mobility?
Absolutely. I see robotics really in two ways. One is mobility, for sure. We've been having lots of discussions and sort of pie in the sky brainstorming around, why has no one reinvented the cane? Why is there not a robotic cane? I don't know what that manifests itself as, but why can't a cane pick me up in my bed and help me get to the bathroom at night and then back, you know? So I do think there's some really fascinating things to come with robotics. The other one is medication adherence and companionship, right? So there's devices now you're seeing in the market. There's one called Pillow Health that's a little robot. And not only is he a companion for you, he has a cartridge in the back that sort of, think of Keurig coffee, think of, you know, Keurig for medication dispensing,
mm-hmm.
right? It can know your care plan. It works off facial recognition. It dispenses your medication at the right time, the right dose. It can't completely know that you've taken your meds, but it can with a much higher degree of certainty than anything else out there, know that you've taken your meds. Mm-hmm. But it also enables for you to engage with it, right? Whether it's about, you know, whatever illnesses you have and your medication you're taking, or just trying to combat, you know, isolation and loneliness. Because if you're at home, right, you probably want someone to talk to. So I think robots are going to play a big role there.
There are some countries where they've been working pretty hard at that, aren't there?
Absolutely. You're seeing quite a bit, actually, over in you know, Japan, China. I think, you know, you're seeing interesting players like Toyota, right? The car organization has bet hugely on tech that's robotics, that not just for cars. Stanley Black & Decker making big investments in robot, you know, in particular medication dispensing robots. So you're seeing not just different countries, but you're seeing unexpected players jump into the field, big and small.
What about the driverless or the self-driving vehicles? Is that considered a promising option for older people going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. One of the biggest fears of folks over the age of 70 is that, you know, son or daughter or some loved one's going to take their car keys away.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then that automatically says, well, I want to live in my house, but if I don't have a car, then I'm going to be, you know, isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that's the downward spiral. So the idea of autonomous vehicles, whether it's a car, whether it's a bus, and I think, you, by the way, you're going to see more adoption in the sense of bus or fleet vehicles than you're going to see in cars in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
In specific to, you know, if you think about a 55-plus community maybe, where there may be almost, I equate it to like a college campus where they have the bus circuit.
Uh-huh.
I'll imagine if there was, you know, there were autonomous or semi-autonomous vehicles that were the bus circuit for the community, right? Let you get around without having to worry about it. And I think there's an intersection not just with autonomous vehicles, but you start talking about wearables, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can empower someone through a wearable that could connect to the vehicle, the autonomous vehicle, which would know, for example, that maybe I have dementia. And so the bus, you know, when I leave the door to the bus, my wearable is communicating with me. When I get on the bus is now communicating with me, and it's a completely connected experience. And it could even be prompting me, make sure you go back to the spot to get the bus. Right? So you think about it as like a user journey. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about the vehicle, because you got to get to the vehicle, and you got to, when you get off the vehicle, you got to go someplace. So how can you leverage all the tech to create a connected experience?
You know, I'm kind of wondering, this is certainly a concern of AARP, Andy Miller, but going forward, what about the affordability of all of this? We know we're entering a new, I don't know what I want to call it, era when older people are not as secure financially as maybe they were, you know, coming out of the 50s and 60s.
Absolutely. It's a major concern, right? Whether you're thinking about it from the angle of Social Security to we're just living longer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just going to be a need. The days of, you know, you work, you retire, you know, you live another 10 years and then you die, that's long gone. So when you think about technology, I'll give you an example with the autonomous vehicle. You know, if you ask people, and we did this up at MIT, if you ask people, would you buy one? And then a lot of them will say yes. And then you say, well, what if it costs $100,000? And you see all the hands go down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then said, well, what if when you weren't using it because it's autonomous, it became a fleet vehicle? So maybe Uber and Lyft are nothing but autonomous fleet vehicles that are owned by people, and when they're not using them, that's how they pay for the vehicle. So I think you're starting to see some interesting business models that will be created to help. I mean, Airbnb, I don't think when they launched they ever thought they were going to have such a large group of 50-plus hosts, right? I think they assumed the 50-plus person would travel, but you're seeing more and more people leverage technology, like gig economy technology like Airbnb, mm-hmm. to make money. And so technology is creating outlets for people to continue to earn income as they age, even if they step out of the workforce.
Andy Miller, it's been fun talking to you. I appreciate your time today.
Great. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Andy Miller, Vice President of Innovation for AARP. He visits the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas every year. And this year, AARP had its own demonstrations of what's ahead in technology for older Americans. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple has unveiled a raft of smart battery cases just last week for iPhone XS, iPhone XS Max, and the iPhone XR. The idea is to extend the battery life by some 20 hours, but those hours don't come cheap. Joining us by phone to talk about that and more, contributing editor for Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So what are these cases? They're smart battery cases. How do they work? What do they do?
So this is actually a silicone case that has a battery stuck in it, and it's actually not the first time that Apple has done this. The original versions of this actually skipped a generation. The iPhone X did not have these smart battery cases, but the idea is that you slide this silicone case on, and on top of providing a little bit of extra protection, should you drop your phone, you get considerable battery that attaches through the lightning port on the phone.
And what they're pricey. Why?
Oh, they do a lot. I mean, these are not just batteries that are kind of stuffed into cases. There's quite a bit of smarts going on here. These are $129 cases. And what you're actually getting is the same kind of charge speed and capability that you would get if you were plugging in a normal lightning cable. You're charging at the same rate that you would if you were charging on something at home.
Oh.
And these batteries also do what's called the wireless charging pass-through. So your existing iPhone X and iPhone XS have the ability to charge wirelessly. You put them on top of a wireless charging plug instead of sticking something in the port, and you can actually charge the phone. This battery you can also place on top of a wireless charger, and it will charge both the battery and the phone in one go. So if you have a wireless charger and you currently love that wireless charger, you actually don't have to take the case off in order to use it, which is really rare for wireless or for battery packs that get added to phones.
How are they achieving that? How does that work?
A lot of this has to do with the wireless charging, you know, antenna that allows it to receive that is also built into the case. So it has its own version of that technology that is built into the phone is also built into the case, and that power is being run through the connection to the phone in kind of the most direct way that they could manage.
And you said that it does it as fast or faster than if I just plugged it into the wall?
Right. The idea here is that you're not actually compromising, and you're not put in a position to need to take the phone off the charger, not need to take the case off the phone at any point. You get the same experience that you normally would if you were connected directly.
And so it extends the life of the phone for about 20 hours or so?
Yeah. So the promise here from Apple is 39 hours of talk and 22 hours of internet use.
Okay.
The other. So if you end up using the phone a lot for actual phone calls, it's a weird thing, right?
I was going to say, who does that?
Right. So that's the iPhone XR actually is the one that gives you 22 hours of internet and 39 hours of talk. If you have the iPhone XS Max, the big version of the iPhone X, you get an additional 20 hours of internet. And if you have the XS, which is the smaller version of that phone, then you get 21 hours of internet.
Is the phone always charging then?
It's not, actually. That's a big part of why they call it a smart battery case, is the phone is actually built because your phone actually behaves a little differently when it is plugged into something that is delivering power. So it's actually using more power when it's plugged in because it thinks that it is connected to a wall. And so every phone kind of behaves a little differently when it's plugged in like that. To avoid that, Apple has some software when connected to this case that gives me just some additional flexibility. Like if I want the battery to die first, I can enable that in settings. If I want the phone to charge to drop down to a certain percentage and then start using the battery, then that's a feature that can be enabled as well. There's
okay.
a lot of flexibility there instead of just kind of constantly delivering power.
Are there other such kinds of cases out there for other kinds of phones? Is this something that's going to become a thing?
This is something that is difficult to do for other phones because there just frankly aren't as many of the other phones out there. Like Apple's iPhone series is the most popular for a reason. The number that gets sold justify a case like this and the expense that goes along with it. There are other manufacturers, Mophie being one, that makes versions of this case both for the iPhone and for other phones. And they function in a kind of similar fashion, but they're also a little bit thicker in their design. Whereas this, the phone is actually pretty close to its original shape in most of the case. And then kind of around the back, you can feel the kind of bulge where the battery is.
Do you think this is a good direction for Apple to be going in? I mean, they have had an issue about... what's the word that they've reached the point of people aren't buying phones fast enough to support their other operations, that they have to do something different. Is this enough to turn people to an Apple?
I think that this is something that will keep people, you know, considering other options. One of the most common complaint that everyone has about every phone, regardless of the manufacturer or mm-hmm. how they use it, is I wish the battery lasted a little longer.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't matter who you ask or what they do with it. That's you know, charging your phone is kind of a chore, especially if it has to be charged at an inconvenient point.
Mm-hmm.
By making it so that your battery lasts more than that kind of standard full day, then yeah, it's one of those things that keeps you interested in using the phone and not having to worry about carrying around a battery or anything.
This is a little off topic, but why is it that it takes longer to charge my phone in a car than it does in the wall?
Your car, most chargers for the car do not output at the same rate. You can
okay.
buy special chargers for your car that will output at that higher rate, and it will charge as fast in your car as it will at home.
Uh-huh.
But most of the chargers that you will buy for car chargers are not rated to do that.
Oh, and Kate, the final question is, what do these smart battery cases look like?
They have two colors.
Cute?
One is white and one is black, and they are very standard kind of silicone-looking cases. They're not super attractive-looking. They're not. They're very kind of bland. I will say that the last time Apple did this, They released the white version and the black version initially, and then a few months later released a product red version, which was a kind of a bright red case that looked a lot better. So if you're not totally sold on this and would prefer to have a color that is not flat white or flat black, I would suggest waiting a little while. But you're probably not going to get too much more exciting than that from Apple. Their case designs are historically not overly flashy.
Okay. You wrote about a new Ace Combat game. Tell us what you reviewed it. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Definitely a thumbs up. I have a weakness for flight simulation games. It's been something that I've been a fan of ever since I was a kid. The idea of, you know, kind of sitting in a special space with, you know, controllers that feel like the cockpit of a plane and flying around is something that's always been a thing that I'm a fan of. I love seeing actual airplanes. I'm fortunate enough to live near the Udvar-Hazy Museum, where there's just a massive collection of airplanes.
Well, you live pretty close to an airport, too.
I do live walking distance from an airport, yeah. So I have a lot of airplanes in my life already. Ace Combat 7 is the latest in a line of games that allows you to play fighter jets and simulations. You know, a massive array of fighter jets. But more than that, it is an actual fun game. It's not just a simulation. There's a story that goes along with it that's pretty compelling. And the gameplay is a lot of fun. And if you are playing the game on PlayStation, you can actually play a bunch of the missions inside a PlayStation VR headset. So instead of just looking at a screen, you can actually turn your head and look around and feel like you are in the cockpit of a fighter jet, which is the closest I will ever get to actually being in the cockpit of a fighter jet due to my own personal fears. But it's a lot of fun.
Do you need any special gear?
If you just want to play the game, you have a PlayStation 4 or an Xbox or a PC, then the game itself is $60 and you can pick it up and start playing. But like many other flight simulations, you can add a lot to kind of complete that experience. You can add what are called hands-on throttle and stick controllers, which give you the ability to kind of accelerate and turn using sticks that feel very similar to what you would get in the cockpit of a plane. And then, like I said, if you have a PlayStation 4, you can add a virtual reality headset and really feel like you're in the game.
Are there lots of people out there like you who like to be in simulators?
I don't know that there are lots of us, but I know that there are enough that every once in a while another company decides to make a game like this. They are not quite as popular as they used to be. There used to be a lot of flight simulators that came out on a pretty regular basis, but now we get one game like this every couple of years, and it ends up being, you know, something that consumes a lot of our attention and excitement for a while before we end up moving on.
Is this a military-grade simulation?
No, this is actually, it is not a military grade simulation. It uses a lot of military language, and it uses a lot of military visuals. You can fly in things that look very similar to modern military aircraft, but having just recently come from a Lockheed Martin demonstration in a virtual reality headset with a proper military grade installation, they are very different experiences. This is more about having fun and less about feeling realistic.
Where did you have an opportunity to do that?
That was at the Consumer Electronics Show for very briefly. The people at Lockheed were giving demonstrations in coordination with the HTC Vive I that was released.
Wow, that's pretty cool. You must have been pretty happy about that.
I was very happy about that, but I wasn't able to like take any pictures or anything, so I wasn't able to brag about it to many people.
And it compares to other aerial combat games. How?
This is definitely competing with you know, even kind of space combat simulators that we have out right now, like Elite Dangerous and games like that, in that it just has a lot of different source material that you can go through. There's a lot of different missions, and you can unlock something like 35 different jets, both active and inactive jets that you can fly and just have a lot of fun with.
Can you do it with other people?
You cannot do it with a lot of other people. It's not like a massive online multiplayer thing. This is really more of a kind of solo experience. But you can, and I have been in rooms of people just kind of passing the headset off, and that ends up being a lot of fun.
Okay. I don't even know what to call this. You want to talk about the DJI Osmo Pocket. So start off telling us what it is.
This is a camera. It's kind of a unique camera. DJI has a name for making drones and also making camera accessories. One of these camera accessories is a gimbal, where you put your phone or you put your camera on this thing, and it auto stabilizes the video for you. So it actually uses some artificial intelligence to you know, anticipate your movement and electronically stabilize the camera that you have connected to it, as well as allow for facial tracking and things like that, so that the camera actually moves to track the object that you've told it to track or the person that you told it to track, while you kind of walk around a scene. And cinematographers have been using these for a long time to get very difficult shots in you know, very active situations. And the creation of the DJI Osmo Mini is taking all of that technology and just shrinking it down into something that instead of requiring its own separate carrying case for, actually fits in the palm of your hand and can very easily slide into your pocket.
It's small.
It is so small. It is surprisingly small for what it is. It is essentially the same kind of camera that you would get on a modern phone attached to one of these electronically stabilized gimbals with a little pad for you to control with your thumb. And very little else. It is a very, very small thing.
Smaller than a bread box.
Definitely smaller than a bread box.
Smaller than a phone?
It is smaller than a phone, but not thinner than a phone.
Okay.
It's really, you know, right about as thick as two chapsticks side by side and about as tall as one and a half of them.
Wow.
So it is deceptively small. And when you see pictures of it, it really doesn't do a very good job conveying just how small this thing is when you hold it. And that was something that as my video team was using it, they were just amazed by how small it was and how well it worked.
$350 though.
These are expensive machines. You know, the idea here, the electronic stabilization, you know, you can usually get an electronic stabilizer for, you know, your existing phone for about $130 if you want a really good one with software that goes along with it. And so that's, you know, what you're paying for there is the you know, camera and everything to be contained. You don't have to connect anything to this in order to use it. You can connect a phone to it if you want kind of a bigger display to use while you are using it, but mm-hmm. you can very quickly pull this out of your pocket and capture something. So this ends up replacing kind of the quick, you know, quick camera or the GoPro or something that you would end up using for those kind of recordings.
Okay. All right. And are there attachments and things to go with it, or is it $350 all in?
This is $350 all in. The only real accessory that you're going to want to use on a regular basis would be the attachment that allows you to connect your phone.
Okay.
And that's specifically if you want a larger screen or some additional features to play around with as you're using it. But in most cases, you're going to use it on its own. You're not really going to attach much to it.
Another game is the Vinpok Split Review. I mean, is the Vinpok Split. Is that right?
Yeah, this has kind of a funny name to it. Vinpok Split is actually a monitor. It's actually a portable screen that you hook up to your computer. This is something that I run into on a fairly regular basis. Is that my home desktop has multiple monitors, and I have kind of a very particular workflow when it comes to those machines. But when I am away from home, I shrink everything down to one screen, and it's kind of tedious to flip back and forth. You know, when I'm sitting in a hotel trying to get a bunch of stuff done, having that one screen is kind of limiting.
Mm-hmm.
And so Vinpok makes this display.
Are you there, Russell? We lost Russell, but that's okay. We'll have to talk about Vinpok Split next week. We have lost Russell Holly. That's very sad, but not horrible because we're also out of time. So that's it for Tech Tuesday. It failed us. Technology failed us once again, but far enough along in the program, it didn't hurt too much. So thank you for listening. Thanks to Russell Holly. And that's it for today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.